The United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit is now open and in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, all. I now call up docket number 20-1073, Arellano v. Tran. You may note we've changed the caption to reflect the change in the secretary's status. To just review as a preliminary matter briefly, appellant will have 51 minutes for the main argument and 8 minutes for rebuttal. We will begin with 3 minutes uninterrupted non-questioning by the counsel, followed by a first round of questioning, 3 minutes per judge, going by order of seniority, which will consist of both the question and the answer, if we can handle that, followed by a second round of 1 minute. Same process will be followed with Ms. Thomas on the other side. So I think we're ready to begin, Mr. Barney. 3 minutes uninterrupted time, then followed by questions. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The question in this appeal is simple. Is 38 U.S.C. 5110b1 amenable to equitable tolling? Now, figuring out the answer to that question is not exactly simple, but the Supreme Court has set forth a clear roadmap, which consists of two basic inquiries. Does the Irwin presumption apply? And if so, can the government rebut it? On the first question, we believe 5110b1 meets all the criteria necessary to warrant the Irwin presumption. It's a statutory time limit set forth in a statute for which Congress has waived sovereign immunity. And unlike the statutory provision in Sebelius v. Auburn, 5110b1 is not aimed at sophisticated institutional litigants represented by counsel. It's aimed at military veterans who have just been discharged from service, who are unrepresented by counsel, and who may be suffering from the very physical or mental disabilities that 5110b1 was intended to address. So we believe the Irwin presumption clearly applies. The government disagrees, and its primary argument is that Irwin only applies to statutes of limitations, and according to the government, 5110b1 is not a statute of limitations. But the Supreme Court has never held that the Irwin presumption only applies to statute of limitations. For instance, the court in Zipes found equitable tolling was available for an administrative filing deadline that the court described as being like a statute of limitations. The word like implies that equitable tolling is available for provisions that may fall outside a strict definition of a statute of limitations. Moreover, the concept of a statute of limitations is not as clear-cut as the government suggests. In Young, for example, the Supreme Court held that a statute that imposed a 3-year look-back period on the IRS's ability to prioritize tax debts in a bankruptcy proceeding was a statute of limitations and was amenable to equitable tolling. The 1-year filing deadline in 5110b1 operates as a statute of limitations every bit as much as the 3-year look-back period in Young. In fact, it would be an odd result if the IRS, a powerful government agency, could benefit from equitable tolling of a look-back period, but a disabled veteran could not. Now, moving to the second inquiry, we don't believe the government can rebut the Irwin presumption. Its main argument is that 5110b1 is an exception to the default rule, and therefore cannot be equitably tolled for the reasons set forth in TRW. But the provision in TRW involved a 2-year limitations period with a built-in tolling provision that automatically stopped the clock under certain circumstances. The court found that applying a discovery accrual rule on top of this would render the built-in tolling provision wholly superfluous. That's not the case here. There's nothing in Section 5110 that can stop the 1-year clock of subsection B1 for any reason. So nothing in the statute would be rendered superfluous if this court held that 5110b1 is amenable to equitable tolling. In closing, I'd like to thank the court for its careful consideration of this important issue, and I am ready to answer your questions.
Thank you, Mr. Barney. This is Chief Judge Prost. Let me begin by asking you about Irwin's relationship to a court's inherent power to equitably toll deadlines. Unlike courts, however, agencies such as the VA do not have any inherent equitable powers, much less the equitable powers of a court. Rather, agencies have only post powers granted to them by Congress. Has VA, let me ask you, been granted a court's power to equitably toll deadlines? And if so, what is the source of that authority? And finally, how is that supposed to work? We've got 50 or so regional offices with hundreds of individual adjudicators. And I guess under your view of how this case should be resolved, each of them would have the authority to decide the equitable tolling question. And as I'm sure you know, under the recent Veterans Modernization Act, 5104A speaks to the binding nature of favorable rulings. In other words, if an individual adjudicator finds equitable that the individual claimant's claim should be equitably tolled, the government, the VA, and no one else can ever call it to question, except in the extraordinary circumstances, possibly of a CUE.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll attempt to address that as best I can in the time limit that I have. Regarding your question as to whether the agency itself has the power to equitably to apply equitable tolling, I believe the answer to that is yes. There have been cases such as the Fisher case from the Court of International Trade that recognized the Department of Labor's ability and power to equitably toll certain deadlines. But more importantly, I don't think this court actually needs to answer that question, because the legal question that we're asking the court to decide here is whether the Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims has the power to should have considered Mr. Arellano's equitable tolling argument. And I don't think there's any question that the CAVC has the equitable power to toll a deadline. This court has already held.
But we're not going to try to push every claim up to the CAVC until we get to the equitable tolling question. As I mentioned, if an adjudicator gets to make that determination and the veteran prevails, that would be the end of it, and it would never get to the CAVC.
I understand your point, Your Honor. My point is that whether the VA can promulgate rules to allow the RO and the BVA to adjudicate equitable tolling claims, I think is solely within the province of the VA. And if you look at the footnote 6 in the government's brief, they acknowledge that there is a statute that would allow them to promulgate such rules. So whether or not the rules currently exist to allow them to do it, I believe they have the power to do it if they want.
Thank you. Judge Newman.
Okay. I'd like us to put this, if we can, in the context of what we're talking about in this case, because of the significant differences in precedent and factual situations, and the fact that on this appeal we are being asked to come up with a general rule of law that would always apply. For instance, suggest that we should overrule our decision of some years ago in the Andrews case, where the veteran was 3 months late after the initial one-year period and asked that initial one-year period statement should be told so that her entitlement came from the date of discharge, not the 15 months later. Now, here we have a veteran who waited 30 years, and in your brief, you say right up front that you're looking at the first year period, that's the period that you want to be sure is open to equitable tolling. Are you therefore, is your position that if we agree, and we certainly the role of courts is to do justice and equity, whatever that takes, that then this veteran will be entitled to 30 years of retroactive benefits? So that's my first question.
Thank you, Judge Newman. Our position is that the veteran should be entitled to make out his case and have his case considered for equitable tolling. As you know, equitable tolling...
What are you tolling? The entire 30 years? That's what I want to understand, because you were not clear.
Okay. So if the veteran were able to prevail on equitable tolling, then yes, he would potentially be entitled to 30 years of benefits But the point I wanted to make is that we know that...
Is that your position? I mean, is this the concrete position that brought this case before us, that he would be entitled to 30 years of benefits if we hold, and it's not an untenable argument, that because he was injured in service, he was not capable of focusing on the availability of benefits for 30 years? You're saying that 30 years of tolling is what this case is all about?
Your Honor, yes. But as I was saying, in order to make out his equitable tolling case, he would need to show that there was no more than 1 year of time during that 30 years where he was capable of filing his claim, because equitable tolling stops a clock, but the clock restarts when the conditions that
stops
cause...
what clock?
It stops, in this case, it would stop the one-year clock of 5110B1. But
so that's
when the conditions...
entirely a matter of retroactivity of... it has nothing to do with disability or service connection. It's a matter of how far back, as a matter of organization, the claimant can go in the administration of the statute. Isn't that right?
It does control the effective award date. That's correct. But I would disagree that it's merely a retroactivity clause. It's there to encourage the claimants to file ripe claims in a timely manner. And so a veteran who has a disability, a severe disability after leaving service, who files that claim within that 1 year, even if that claim doesn't end up being adjudicated for 10 years, will be entitled to the full length of time.
Okay, so here we have a veteran who filed after 30 years, made no attempt to file earlier, says that he wasn't capable of filing earlier. That's an important point that, of course, we shouldn't ignore. But what you're asking for, I want to be clear, if this is what you're asking for, is tolling for 30 years.
What we're asking for
is that
the
yes or no answer.
The short answer is yes, Your Honor, yes.
Judge Lori.
Thank you, Chief. Mr. Bonney, Irwin states that the same rebuttable presumption of equitable tolling applicable to suits against private parties should apply to suits against the federal government. But how does that apply when there is no private suit analog?
Well, Your Honor, I think the Supreme Court addressed that in the Scarborough case and found that it's not necessary to find an exact private analog, especially when you're looking at a government benefits program. And as this court has recognized in Bailey and other cases, the Veterans Benefits Program and the statute is very unique. Even among other benefits programs, it's unique. And therefore, it's not surprising that you won't find an exact private analog. But again, the Supreme Court in Scarborough put to rest the notion that it's necessary to find a precise private analog.
Well, let me ask you further. 5110A1 provides that the effective date for benefits will not be earlier than the date of receipt of the application. So B1, providing for a one-year grace period, is an exception. You're asking exception to that, an exception to an exception. Isn't that legislating, rewriting the statute, which we're not entitled to do?
No, Your Honor, I disagree. I agree that it's an exception to the default rule, but all statutes of limitations are exceptions to a default rule. So the Federal Tort Claims Act, for instance, says that a claim against the government shall be forever barred. That's the default rule based on sovereign immunity, unless the claimant files their claim within 2 years of the cause of action. That's the exception to the default rule. And the Supreme Court and common law has routinely found that those exceptions to default rules are subject to equitable tolling.
Well, this really isn't a statute of limitations, is it? It doesn't cut off benefits for a late filing. It only determines their effective date.
We'd argue that this is in the nature of a statute of limitations. It's every bit as a statute of limitations as the provision in Young, which the Supreme Court acknowledged was substantive in nature and really only affected the amount that the IRS could recover against the bankrupt taxpayer, not whether the IRS could maintain a claim at all. And he described that as being a limited statute of limitations, but a statute of limitations nonetheless.
Thank you.
Judge Dyke.
Thank you. Mr. Barney, for purpose of this question, let's assume that the Irwin presumption applies because of the Young case or whatever else. But the question that I have is whether the presumption has been rebutted. And in that respect, it seems to me that you and the government share an assumption that equitable tolling is an all-or-nothing proposition. And it seems to me that perhaps that assumption is incorrect. Let's take, for example, in the disability area, we have a guardian provision where a court-appointed representative can file on behalf of an incompetent veteran, 5101A2 in D1, and we have the tolling provision with respect to pension and disability situations, and we have legislative history of the discharge provision itself suggesting that the one-year look-back provision is designed to take account of disabilities that prevent the veteran from filing. And in the overall scheme, it seems to me that Congress could not have intended a 30-year look-back tolling for disability. On the other hand, with respect to a claim for equitable tolling based on actions by the VA that prevent the veteran from filing, as shown by the Wood, the Rabin case, the statute provides for a duty to assist, and some of our cases suggest that the violation of a statutory obligation like that, there is tolling. The Wood case, the Simpson case, involving notification of entitlement to former spouse annuities. So my question to you is, why shouldn't we look at this statute more granularly so that tolling is appropriate in some circumstances but not others? It's appropriate for situations where the VA is at fault but not for disability. Why isn't that an appropriate construction of the statute?
Thank you, Your Honor. I don't think that would necessarily be an inappropriate way to look at it. The problem is, in order to get into that granularity, in order to determine which set of facts are going to give rise to a viable claim for equitable tolling, you first have to get rid of the Andrews bar, because right now the VA is not looking at any facts.
I'm assuming that we do that, that we say that you get a presumption of equitable tolling. But what I'm asking you is, why can't we distinguish between disability situations, which require a 30-year look back, and situations where the VA is at fault, as is the case in the Rabin situation?
Your Honor, I don't disagree with that. If equitable tolling is generally permitted, then there's nothing wrong with, in my opinion, of looking more granularly and determining perhaps it's going to be available in certain circumstances, but not available in other circumstances. I think that's consistent with this court's existing jurisprudence.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Moore.
I have no questions.
Judge O'Malley.
Yes, Mr. Barney, I have a couple things, and we'll see if we can get through them. But first, is it possible to reconcile the court's language in Begley that expressed statutory language effectively allowing for equitable tolling rebuts the Irwin presumption with the language in Young and Holland and even our court's language in Clower saying that the existence of equitable tolling exceptions might actually indicate a beneficence throughout the entire statute?
Your Honor, I think that it's a matter of nexus. I mean, it is you've put your finger on a interesting, you know, disconnect perhaps. But I think the case law suggests that the closer the equitable exception is to the time period at issue, the more likely it's going to be perceived as essentially rebutting the presumption. And so I think that would be the situation in Beggarly, for instance. It was also the situation in the TRW case. The more attenuated it becomes, so in other words, if you have to jump to a different provision or a different part of the statute to find an exception, the less the nexus is, and the more it becomes more of a general proposition that Congress clearly intended equity to apply generally to the statute, and therefore it can't serve to rebut the Irwin presumption. I hope that answers your question, but I'm not sure it did.
Yes, I think so. Thank you.
Do you have anything further, Judge O'Malley?
Well, I might have one other question, and that is, what makes the exceptions in 5110E through N different from the explicit listing of exceptions in Brockamp?
Your Honor, first, those exceptions, each one of them applies to a different type of benefit. Those aren't exceptions to the timing provision that's at issue here, which is a specific one-year timing provision that applies to disability benefits for discharged veterans. And also, the exceptions in Brockamp, it was a time period that included specific exceptions that would actually toll the time period. These so-called exceptions in Section 5110 aren't tolling any time period. For instance, there's nothing in Section 5110 that will ever stop the clock, the one-year clock set forth in 5110B1. So I think that's the difference.
Thank you.
Judge Reyna.
Yes, Mr. Barney. Good morning. My question relates to the pro-veterans canon, which is the statutory interpretation principle that provisions for benefits to members, and I want to emphasize provisions for benefits to members, of the armed forces are to be construed in the beneficiary's favor. What's your position with respect to how the pro-veterans canon applies in this case? And perhaps you can explain what, if any, ambiguity exists in Section 5110B1 that might invoke the canon? And also, how exactly would the pro-veterans canon apply to that ambiguity, if in fact one exists?
Thank you, Your Honor. We certainly believe and agree that there is a long-standing canon that veterans' statutes are to be construed in the veterans' favor at every turn. With respect to your question of ambiguity, you know, as one example, the parties here, the government, Mr. Arellano, are having a bit of a dispute about whether 5110B1 is sufficiently similar to a statute of limitations that it should be receive the Irwin presumption. And to the extent this court sees that as being a close call, the benefit of the doubt should flow to the veteran. And the same applies to if the Irwin presumption applies and you get to some of these subsidiary questions about whether it can be rebutted, perhaps going, for instance, to Judge O'Malley's question, whether there are exceptions here that make this statute more like the statute in Beggarly as opposed to the statute in Irwin or in Young. Again, we would say that any benefit of the doubt should flow in the veteran's favor.
Thank you.
Judge Wallach.
I pass. Thank you.
Judge Toronto.
Thanks. Mr. Barney, I have two questions, both against the backdrop of the Appropriations Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which, as I understand it, and reflected in OPM against Richmond, requires that courts be very protective of Congress's control of the public purse and therefore broadly demands adherence to textual preconditions for spending public money. Now, Irwin recognizes an exception for a certain category of laws that are so widely known in the law to carry case-by-case equity discretion that we simply presume Congress was implicitly authorizing use of that discretion to authorize payouts without satisfying textual preconditions. My first question is this. Given the Appropriations Clause principle, isn't even significant uncertainty about whether 5110B is an Irwin-type law enough to mean that we should not conclude that Congress was implicitly authorizing non-textual payouts? And then second and related, aren't there at least the following bases for uncertainty? Irwin laws all appear to set times for going to tribunals to seek a remedy based on a pre-existing legal duty. But here, there is no pre-existing, that is, pre-claimed VA duty to pay benefits, because at a minimum, 5101 forbids the VA to pay benefits before a claim is filed. And the language of effective date and retroactive is the language of establishing the legal duty itself, not statute of limitations language. That'll be enough if you can address both of those things.
Sure. Well, first of all, with respect to Richmond, this particular provision is not anything like the provision of Richmond. In Richmond, the problem was that there was no statute anywhere on the books that would have authorized the payment.
I agree with that. Can you shift to why the principle at stake doesn't mean what I asked you to address?
Sure. So with respect to whether uncertainty itself should essentially augur against applying the Irwin presumption, I don't see that in Irwin. I think that the Irwin presumption is fairly straightforward. It is that the Irwin presumption shall apply to any statutory time limit to the same extent that it applies in civil litigation. I don't see uncertainty being a factor. And if it was a factor, I think that it would be outweighed by the general canon that any uncertainty should be resolved in the veteran's favor in the case
of
the veteran.
Have you seen any provision in the Supreme Court cases recognizing equitable tolling that uses the language of effective date and retroactive, which is the ordinary language for prescribing duties, not for setting times for seeking of remedies that pre-exist? I wasn't able to find any.
The closest I'm aware of would be the Young case, but I don't think I can pinpoint one that fits exactly what you just described, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Chen.
Yes, thank you. Hello, Mr. Barney. I'm still trying to think about how to understand if 5110B1 is a statute of limitations or is akin to a statute of limitations, in that typically a statute of limitations assigns a date to when your ability to enforce your rights ends. And what we have here in front of us is a statute that defines the date your award begins. And so I'm having trouble matching those two concepts up. I understand you're focusing a lot on the Young opinion, and I'm trying to understand your interpretation of Young and why, in your view, the statute there is similar to the statute here. As I understand Young, the statutory provision there ended up barring the IRS from being able to assert that claim. And it lost its rights to do so because it was outside of the 3-year window once the taxpayer filed the bankruptcy petition. So I guess in that sense, why wasn't that provision in Young something of a situational time bar, in that the IRS is barred if its claim for taxes is older than 3 years and in the situation where the taxpayer goes into bankruptcy?
Thank you, Your Honor. So just to address your last point first, I think in Young, the court did not use the word barred. The court acknowledged that the provision did not preclude the IRS from pursuing all claims against the taxpayer. It only affected certain aspects of the claim, dischargeability of the debt and priority of the debt. And that's why the Supreme Court said it's not, the Supreme Court acknowledged that this was not exactly the same as a traditional statute of limitations for that reason, but it was nevertheless a limited statute of limitations and therefore amenable to equitable tolling. If I could get to your other point, your first point.
Well, can we just stay on Young for a second?
Sure.
Just so I make sure I understand what you understand to be dischargeability, what is your understanding of that?
That my understanding,
IRS can't, the taxpayer no longer has to pay the debt on the tax claim. Is that right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The debt would be discharged, so the IRS would not be able to.
The loss of a right that the IRS initially had to enforce.
It didn't technically remove the right as like a statute of limitations would. It affected the amount that the IRS could recover. So the IRS could have multiple tax liens against a taxpayer over multiple years, and they would be able to recover any of the debts that were within the 3-year look-back period, but they would not be able to recover the debts outside the 3-year look-back period.
The debts are attached to claims. This is what I'm trying to understand. I mean, to me, it looks like there was a claim for back taxes. The IRS delayed in pursuing that claim, and then the taxpayer eventually went into bankruptcy, and then the debt on that tax claim ended up getting discharged. So why isn't that, as a functional matter, very much the same thing as a bar on the IRS's tax claim, which therefore is basically a statute of limitations, and through that, the Irwin presumption applies?
I think it is. I think that's what the Supreme Court ultimately decided, but also acknowledged that it doesn't operate exactly like a statute of limitations. It affected the amount that the government could recover, because the government could recover other claims in other tax years, but there was a cutoff as to how far back it could go. So collectively,
so are you saying then, I'm sorry, I want to make sure I completely understand it. So for tax years that the taxpayer did not pay tax for, each of those tax years is an individual claim. And if for those claims were back taxes that arose inside the 3 years, those were not barred. But those for those claims of tax years that were older than the 3-year look-back period, then those ended up getting barred through being discharged. Am I understanding it correctly?
I think that's correct. Again, I apologize. My familiarity with IRS tax code is not real strong, but I just wanted to point out that...
No, we're talking about Young, though, and that's why I'm trying to understand why is it that you are analogizing the Young case, at least factually, to the present case, when what I see going on in Young is a question of individual tax potential claims for different tax years. Some tax years are too old, so they get discharged in the bankruptcy proceeding, but some are still relatively new, and they don't get discharged. And now when we go to your facts here, what we're doing here is assigning an effective date for the amount of compensation. And it's all a single claim. You know, I don't see the desire for retroactive compensation a year back or perhaps more, and for equitable tolling as being a separate individual claim from the claim for ongoing future monthly compensation payments. So this is the trouble I'm having with your analogy with Young, and I was hoping you could clarify that.
I'll do my best, Your Honor, and I know we're past the 3 minutes, but I'll do my best.
Yeah, why don't you take about 30 seconds to try to respond? Thank you.
I will, Your Honor. Thank you. Young specifically noted that unlike most statutes of limitations, the look-back period bars only some but not all legal remedies. And it was pointing to the fact that the IRS still has additional remedies against a bankrupt taxpayers, including equitable remedies. So that's what I was getting at. They didn't use the word bars. It didn't operate exactly like a statute of limitations. The IRS was actually not barred from pursuing those claims, but it did affect some aspects of it that could affect the amount that the IRS could recover. And the Young court made the point that even though this is a substantive part of the IRS's claim and not purely procedural, that doesn't matter. So the Young court did away with this idea that so-called substantive aspects of the claim can never be tollable.
Thank you. Let's turn to Judge Hughes, please.
I pass.
Judge Stowe.
Good morning, Mr. Barney. In Sebelius, the Supreme Court majority stated that this court has never applied Irwin's presumption to an agency's internal appeal deadline. The same could probably be said for an agency's internal filing deadline. Are you aware of any cases where the Supreme Court or regional circuit court applied the Irwin presumption to an agency filing deadline? I know you mentioned the Fisher case earlier, and that was the Court of International Trade, but do you know of any Supreme Court or regional circuit cases?
Yes, Your Honor. I would actually point, in addition to the Fisher case, I would point to Zipes, because Zipes, the deadline at issue in Zipes was the deadline for filing a charge with the EEOC, which is an agency. That was the specific deadline that required tolling in order for the civil lawsuit under Title VII to move forward, because the exhaustion of administrative remedies was a element or a condition precedent for a federal lawsuit under Title VII. So I think that's an example of, yeah.
I thought that Zipes was perhaps decided before Irwin. Is that right?
It was, but it was cited in Irwin. So, in other words, Irwin essentially favorably cited Zipes for this principle that equitable tolling can apply to those types of deadlines.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll now enter our second round, which is a one-minute round. I will pass. Judge Newman.
Well, I'll try and be very brief because I keep bringing us back to reality. And the question is now, from what I've heard, what we're trying to achieve for this veteran is that the provision in the statute, which says that your benefits run from the date of filing, can be told, presumably one would come forward with reasons, which I take it would mean that every veteran, whenever a request for benefits is filed, would then be entitled to say that veteran, the benefits would run from whatever date the veteran can establish might have been a filing date or might be available or is available in justice, in equity. Is that where we're supposed to be going? Is that the purpose of the equitable tolling position that we're being presented with?
Your Honor, I will attempt to address that, but if I'm going the wrong direction, please let me know. The only tolling period, the only period we're asking to be tolled here is the one-year period that applies for the first year after service. So the only veterans who would be affected or would be available to take advantage of what we're arguing here would be veterans who actually had a disability that entitled to benefits during that first year. So we're talking about veterans who get out of the service and already have a disability or they develop a disability during that first year.
You're asking for 30 years. of tolling. That's where I get stuck.
Well, we're not asking for 30 years of tolling, Your Honor. We're only asking for 1 year of tolling because it's a stopwatch. So that was what I was trying to explain earlier. In order for a veteran to actually prove that they're entitled to have 5110B1 equitably tolled, they would have to show that they had a disability that was so severe that they were unable to file. And that disability, that it never abated. Because if it abates for, let's say, 2 years, and they let's say they're taking medication and they're...
Let me interrupt you to make sure that... You're now saying that what Mr. Arellano is asking for is his filing date plus 1 year, not his filing date plus 30 years?
Your Honor, Mr. Arellano, if he has the opportunity to present facts, which he has never had the opportunity to, nobody's ever considered his actual facts yet, he would try to make out a case that he has been severely disabled during that entire time. And so there was never, so the clock stopped. The 1 year clock stopped 30 years ago and has never restarted because it didn't restart until he filed.
All the 1 year did was to say that within the first year, your benefits run from the date of discharge. If you file any time within the year, it isn't any limitations period other than giving you the benefit of a few months after discharge to adjust, and that, it seems to me, is quite a different concept from, again, saying he'd be entitled now to demonstrate that for 30 years he was incompetent and incapable of filing, and therefore the filing date provision of the statute should be tolled or waived.
Your Honor, again, the period that we're asking to be told is only 1 year long.
That period? That's a look-back date. It doesn't affect the rights. It affects the retroactivity.
It affects the effective date, and so it does have a retroactive aspect to it. But you keep referring to 30 years of tolling, and I just wanted to be clear, we're not asking for 30 years of tolling, per se. It's a one-year period.
What are you asking?
Your Honor, if Mr. Arellano is able to present the facts that he believes supports his equitable tolling case, he would argue that he was mentally incompetent during the entire period of time from his discharge from service until his brother, acting as guardian ad litem, filed his actual claim for benefits. And that period was, I believe, in the order of 30 years. Now, whether he'll actually be able to prove that up or not, we don't know, because no court has actually addressed the merits of his claim. And so he may not be able to prove that up, and he may ultimately prevail.
Thank you. Judge Lurie.
Mr. Bonney, just to make clear what we're dealing with respect to an analogy to a statute of limitations, under our present precedent, Mr. Arellano isn't deprived of a benefit. He would have a benefit only as of, 2011, when he made his filing. Isn't that correct?
He would have been entitled to, the medical evidence shows that he was disabled because of an event that occurred during service, and he was disabled from the time he was discharged from service. And so under Mr. Arellano's view, he missed out on benefits to which he was entitled to.
Under present law, he didn't file within a year of discharge. Therefore, he's limited to when he actually filed, which was 2011. Isn't that right? In other words,
he doesn't lose
his claim. It's just a question of timing.
If equitable tolling does not apply, then you are correct. In other words, if he's unable to equitably toll the deadline of 5110B1, then the rule of 5110A1 applies, and there's no exception to it because he can't toll anything, and therefore what you said is correct.
Thank you.
Judge Dyke.
Just a quick question. What does the record show about the date at which the brother was appointed to be the guardian ad litem?
Your Honor, I don't know the date, Your Honor. It was some point prior to his application for actual benefits. I apologize. I don't have the specific date, but basically there was a long period of time where Mr. Arellano, was mentally incompetent. And then at some point his brother intervened and got the process started by filing a claim on his brother's behalf at the regional office. I apologize. I don't have the exact date.
Judge Moore?
Pass.
Judge O'Malley? Judge O'Malley?
Yes, I'm sorry. I was on mute. I just want to clarify something about your response to Judge Dyke in round one. To the extent that you agree that things like factors like whether or not the VA was at fault for purposes of the inability to file within 1 year or the failure to file within 1 year, and that you agree that that's relevant, that would be relevant at the final stage of the inquiry, which is assuming equitable tolling applies, should it apply in this particular case? Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, that was my understanding of the question that was being presented. So assuming equitable tolling applies, then of course this court, the VA as well, would look at the particular facts, and there's a well-developed body of case law they could draw upon to say, well, this particular set of facts doesn't fall into a category that we recognize as being amenable for equitable tolling.
Right, but that wouldn't go to the question of whether equitable tolling should apply in the first place.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that would be true with respect to yours, to Judge Newman, that to the extent that 30 years is part of the inquiry, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. The question of whether 30 years is achievable in this case is completely dependent on the facts, and you don't even get to those facts until you recognize that the statute itself is at least amenable to equitable tolling.
Okay. Thank you.
Judge Reyna.
I'll pass.
Judge Wallach.
I pass.
Judge Taranto.
I pass.
Judge Chen.
Hello again, Mr. Barney. Could we talk about 5110B4? As you know, that's a provision that contemplates, in the context of disability pensions, what how to assign the effective date for that pension when the veteran claimant is totally disabled. And the government made an argument about how when you look at all of these exceptions in 5110B, they look like a very specific, technical, highly reticulated statutory regime of Congress specifying how to assign effective dates in a lot of different circumstances. And B4, on top of what B4 is already addressing, you look at the legislative history in 73 and 84, you see some clear enough statements where Congress seemed to be really driving at how to think about their expectations on when these effective dates would get assigned in a concrete way. And I'm just wondering, could you respond to the government's arguments about B4 and then also those legislative history statements, if you're aware of them, from the House report in 73 and the House conference report in 84?
So with respect to B4, Your Honor, of course, that's a different type of benefit. So it's not the same disability benefit that B1 is addressing.
I understand that. This is more about the fact pattern of the fact that a veteran is totally disabled. Congress understood that that was going to make it particularly hard for
the veteran to come forward immediately after that total disability and chose to give a one-year grace period for that circumstance.
Right. So I think that this fact pattern fits into the observation that the Supreme Court made in Young, as well as in other cases, which is where you find a arguably an equitable provision elsewhere in a statute, far from actually leading you to the conclusion that Congress didn't intend equity to apply to any other provision in the statute, it actually has the opposite effect. So the court said in Young, under a very similar fact pattern, that if anything, that other equitable provision demonstrates that the bankruptcy code incorporates traditional equitable principles. And it goes back to a question I believe, I forget if it was which judge it was, but somebody had asked me a question earlier about how to reconcile those two lines of cases. And I believe that to the extent that B4 is construed as an equitable exception, it's not an equitable exception that would apply to that 5110B1. It's not in a situation like in Beggarly or in the TRW case. It's another section, and that would bring you to a case like Young that says, if anything, that shows that Congress intended equity to apply generally to the statute.
Judge Hughes?
I pass.
Judge Stowe?
I pass.
All right. By my count, Mr. Barney, to retain your rebuttal, you've got about 46 seconds left to wrap it up on this round.
Thank you, Your Honor. Do I need to say anything, or is that it?
It's perfectly. You never, as Judge Lurie, I think, always says, you never get penalized for giving up time. So we will just retain your 8 minutes and 27 seconds for rebuttal, and let's turn to Ms. Thomas.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas, you can begin with your 3 minutes of interrupted speaking.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please the Court. The availability of equitable tolling to alter a statutorily prescribed time period is determined solely by congressional intent. In appropriate contexts where Congress has provided no affirmative evidence of its intent as to tolling, the presumption discussed in Irwin may be deployed to fill that gap. And for the reasons set forth in our brief, the Irwin presumption can't be properly applied to Section 5110B1, and then I'm happy to answer the Court's questions on that point today. That being said, there is actually no need to determine the applicability of that presumption in this matter because Congress has provided unmistakable evidence of its intent regarding the prospect of tolling the time period set forth in Section 5110. That evidence is the text of the statute itself, and that text clearly indicates that Congress did not intend to allow equitable tolling. Contrary to what Mr. Arellano appears to argue in his brief, and tolling the one-year period described in Section B1 would not involve implying an exception to the rule set forth in that particular section, B1 itself. That rule only controls what the effective date will be for a claim submitted within 1 year after discharge. It does not specify what the effective date will be for claims that are submitted after the end of that one-year period. Instead, Section 5110A establishes the rule for that scenario, generally speaking, for the scenario in which an initial disability compensation claim like Mr. Arellano's is submitted more than 1 year after discharge. That is the rule whose plain language would be contravened if Mr. Arellano's claim were assigned an effective date earlier than the date of receipt of his claim, and that is the rule to which an exception would have to exist to allow Mr. Arellano to receive an earlier effective date. But there is no express statutory exception to that rule, and that is why Mr. Arellano asked this Court to create an unwritten exception to that rule by invoking the doctrine of equitable tolling. Congress precluded that result in the text of the statute. the rule set forth in subsection A must apply, according to the statute itself, quote, unless specifically provided otherwise in this chapter, end quote. That is in the chapter of the United States Code that governs veterans' claims and effective dates. No provision of that chapter specifically provides for exceptions created through equitable tolling. Instead, Congress explicitly accounted for equitable concerns by adopting the numerous express exceptions contained within the statute itself. That statutory framework makes clear that Congress did not intend to allow for open-ended equitable tolling subject to the discretion of judges. As a result, the judgment of the Veterans Court in this matter should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Chief Judge Prost. Ms. Thomas, let me start you off by directing your attention to the Young case and also to the copyright cases. Those seem to me to be the cases that your friend most relies on for the conclusion that this is the type of statute of limitations. So you've got a couple I'll give you a couple minutes to address one or all of those cases if you have time.
Certainly, Your Honor. So with respect to Young, there are two key facts about that case that explain why Mr. Arellano's reliance is unwarranted. First of all, the court did say in Young that a statute of limitations may only abolish some remedies, not all remedies for a claim. That doesn't make the statute at issue in Young similar to 5110B1 because that statute doesn't abolish any remedies for a claim. The remedy that's available within the one-year period after discharge, which is an award of disability compensation, is the same remedy that's available after that period. Second, even though the statutory limitations period at issue in Young only specifically addressed two particular remedies and their availability based upon timing, in practical effect, there was no remedy for the IRS outside of those two specific remedies, outside of the three-year limitations period that was at issue there. When the court said in Young that, oh, it may be possible that there could be other remedies aside from these, the court in a footnote said it was alluding to equitable remedies such as the possibility of recoupment if the taxpayer presumably should ever happen to sue the government years later. Maybe the IRS would be able to set off any recovery against the unpaid tax claims. Obviously, that's not a claim that a remedy that would have much value to the IRS prospectively because there's no reason to believe it would ever materialize. In practical effect, the only remedies for the IRS to collect on the stale tax claims once, or not stale, to collect on tax claims once the taxpayer had entered into bankruptcy were the two that were specified by the bankruptcy code, either priority, which requires the claims to be paid during the bankruptcy proceedings, or non-dischargeability, which means the claim survives after the proceedings conclude. That's the reason, and that's the only reason the court could conclude in Young that the limitations period there served the function of a statute of limitations by providing repose through eliminating stale claims. If there had been an effective remedy for the IRS still remaining after the bankruptcy claims, bankruptcy process was over, there would have been no repose for the taxpayer.
Our time has run out, so I'll leave it to my colleagues if they're interested in hearing from you on the copyright cases. But let me turn to Judge Newman. Thank you. Judge Newman.
Okay, well, let me turn to another aspect. The court in Irwin, what they really said, as I understand it, was that equitable tolling should be as available against the government as it is available against the private sector. And so let's just take an example. We really don't have all of the facts as to this veteran, but let's assume that he was, in fact, totally disabled for a prolonged period of time, and that it is now established beyond debate that that was service connection. So here, if we were dealing with the private sector, my sense is that a court would be interested in and permitted even by the statute to consider the equities in a particular case. Of course, what troubles me, as I may have already made clear, is that if we remove the limitation that Congress has set by saying, well, you can argue the equities as to how in the world the VA could handle this with all of the veterans in the nation. But as a matter of general principle, why shouldn't equity always be a factor when you eventually end up in court?
Yes, Your Honor. Two pieces to my response. First, the court in Irwin was addressing the question of whether equitable tolling on any basis was available in the first instance, which is a sort of question precedent to whether determining, you know, whether once it's determined that equitable tolling is available, the circumstances of a particular case warrant that relief. So it may be true that in for a statute of limitations where equitable tolling is available as a general matter, a circumstance where a disability prevented the plaintiff from filing for a certain period of time might be that might be grounds for tolling. But it doesn't answer, that wouldn't answer the question of whether in the first instance the statute can be tolled at all, which is what the as I understand it, the court was addressing in Irwin. The second piece is in response to the court's question regarding why shouldn't the court always take into account equity. The problem is that the court's first obligation is to follow the law as embodied by the statutes that Congress has passed and the Constitution, of course, that governs our entire system of law. And if those sources provide for a particular result, then the court's feeling of equity must, you know, give way to the preferences of Congress. And equitable tolling as a doctrinal principle, as the Supreme Court makes clear, is available only if Congress wanted it to be. So the determinative factor is what Congress's intent was, not whether the court may feel in a given case that equity would require a certain result.
Judge Lurie.
No question.
Judge Dyke.
Thank you. Ms. Thomas, I'd like to ask you the same question that I first asked of Mr. Borney, and that is, assuming that there is a presumption of equitable tolling and the question is whether the statute rebuts it, isn't it incorrect to really look at this as an all-or-nothing proposition? And I'm not suggesting that it should be case by case. What I am suggesting, it ought to be category by category. And it seems to me that the statute is pretty clear that Congress has dealt in great detail with the question of disability, both by having a specific provision that the legal representative can file the claim on behalf of the veteran, 5110B4, the tolling provision for in the pension context, and the history of the one-year discharge provision itself. So I could accept the idea that the statute rebuts a presumption of tolling for disability, but it seems to me when you get to situations like the Rabine situation where the government has prevented the individual from filing the disability claim, that there's a strong indication in the statute by the adoption of the duty to assist that if it's the government's fault that you couldn't file on time, that you should be available to get equitable tolling in that situation. So what's the matter with looking at this situation in that more nuanced way?
I think the problem, Your Honor, which is also, I would say, reflected in the fact that there are no cases that I'm aware of that take that sort of granular approach to the availability of equitable tolling.
Cases the other way either, are there?
Well, there are certainly cases in which the court could have taken that approach if it believed it warranted, for example, in any case where the court said that these specific exceptions indicate that Congress had decided when it wanted exceptions to be made and therefore implicitly foreclosed others. The court could have said instead, well, we think that obviously exceptions can't, additional exceptions based on the reasons embodying these exceptions can't be made, but others are available. And I think the reason that that result is one that would be difficult to reach is that, again, the basis of equitable tolling is the availability of it is determined by congressional intent, and the presumption is a blunt tool. You know, we can say that Congress can be assumed to have wanted to allow tolling in circumstances where there's a very long pattern in the common law of tolling a certain type of statute.
How could it be that in the Rabin situation where the government prevented the veteran from filing the claim by classifying the information and prohibiting him from doing it, how could it be that Congress intended that there should be no ability for tolling in that situation?
That situation, to be honest, Your Honor, sounds almost as an argument for equitable tolling on sort of an equitable estoppel ground. And the Supreme Court has made clear that that's not permitted at all in cases where a petitioner is seeking money from the government, because it would be a violation of the Appropriations Clause to allow the conduct of particular government agents to override congressional intent the availability of the remedy.
You're not addressing the question of this statute and whether Congress in this statute indicated that in the Rabin situation there should be no equitable tolling. I find it difficult to find in this statute, put aside Richmond, any indication that somebody in the Rabin situation would not benefit from equitable tolling. Is there such an indication?
Well, that sort of reverses the question, Your Honor. Typically, Congress has to specifically authorize the availability of a remedy, and there is no specific authorization for a remedy here. And in fact, the fact that Congress gave the VA equitable discretion through 38 U.S.C. 503 to offer relief in a case where a veteran or other claimant was disadvantaged by a VA error suggests that, you know, Congress wanted those situations that to be dealt with on a discretionary basis by VA, not by judges creating equitable exceptions. Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Judge Moore?
I cede my time to Judge Dyke in the event that he has any further questions he'd like to pursue in the same vein.
Okay. Judge Dyke, floor is yours.
I don't think, honestly, Ms. Thomas, that you've answered my question as to where in this statute there's any indication that Congress wished to preclude equitable tolling in the Rabin situation, whereas there's quite a lot of indication that it micromanaged, if you will, the disability situation and didn't leave to the courts the ability to shape a remedy which is different. I mean, isn't there a big difference in the statute between disability, the disability situation, and the government fault situation?
Well, here's a response, Your Honor. If Congress had intended that the courts could disregard the plain language of the statute in circumstances where they believed that the VA's conduct had been sufficiently egregious in failing to render assistance or even, you know, doing the opposite and being an obstruction to filing a claim, then presumably Congress would have provided a statutory time period that would have been, here we're talking about the one-year period after discharge. Presumably Congress would have provided a one-year period that would apply to all claimants, but it didn't. There are, for many cases, there are claimants who don't have any service-connected disability within the 1 year after discharge. It doesn't show up until years later, and in fact, the statutory scheme explicitly contemplates that, providing for a presumption of service connection for example, veterans who contract tuberculosis within the 3 years after discharge. And in that case, the default rule applies. It's the effective date cannot be earlier than the date of receipt of claim. There's no period to toll there. If Congress had intended to allow equitable tolling as a means to remedy some failure to assist, it would be strange to write the statute in a way where some claimants would be able to take advantage of that remedy, but others would not.
Okay, I think I'm out of time.
Judge O'Malley.
Yes. Counsel, you make two related arguments. One is that there shouldn't be any equitable tolling because that would be essentially writing into the statute something that wasn't there. And you argue that there also shouldn't be equitable tolling because those exceptions in B through N are effectively equitable exceptions in any event, or akin to equitable exceptions. Now, as to the first, I don't understand how your argument wouldn't apply to every single equitable tolling case. I mean, by definition, there's always something else being written into the statute that allows for equitable tolling where there's no express provision. And then as to the second part, how do you deal with the language in Holland and Young and even in our Clower en banc, where the Supreme Court and we have recognized that the fact that there's exceptions that would be akin to an equitable exception in a statute would also be indicative of the beneficence of Congress with respect to that statutory scheme and actually could support additional equitable provisions?
So with respect to the first question, when a court applies equitable tolling, of course they're implying a term into a statute that isn't there. But the difference is that in the cases where tolling is permitted of a statute of limitations, it's always the same condition that is to which the court finds an exception, which is the claim must be brought within this period or the claim will be barred. And the court implies an exception by saying, well, also if the claim is not brought within that period, but there were extraordinary circumstances that prevented it, then it won't be barred. That's not the kind of language that Section 5110 includes that indicates that Congress didn't want to allow tolling. 5110 says this is the rule, and I'm specifically talking about 5110A. That provision says that this is the rule of decision for determining the effective date unless specifically provided otherwise in this chapter. The rule specifically addresses the role of exceptions to its own default rule, which means that it's addressing precisely the scenario that the doctrine of equitable tolling is supposed to act as a gap filler for. Because the statute itself addresses that scenario, there's no gap to fill. With respect to the second question, when the Supreme Court has looked at exceptions to a statute of limitations to decide whether those exceptions indicate that Congress wanted to take care of equitable considerations itself rather than leaving it to the courts, the Supreme Court has looked at whether the exceptions included are the sort that would be encompassed by the doctrine of equitable tolling in, if it were applied. And if it is, if they are those sorts of exceptions, then the court has found that they indicate Congress's wish to displace the doctrine of equitable tolling. In this case, the exceptions that Congress has provided for the default rule in Section 5110 are precisely the types of exceptions that account for equitable considerations and would be, in many cases, the sorts of grounds that would be invoked to rely upon equitable tolling. So it's entirely consistent, if not dictated, by the Supreme Court's approach to exceptions in its cases, that where the exceptions Congress has provided are themselves addressing equitable considerations, that they indicate a desire to displace the equitable tolling doctrine.
Judge Reyna.
Okay, I want to take us back to the question about the pro-veterans canon. Ms. Thomas, you said that the equitable doctrinal principle is an issue of congressional intent, and that may be true, but it's something that's arguable, and we've heard argument and questions on that this morning. But there's another congressional intent involved here, and that's with respect to the pro-veteran standard. It's clear, and I don't know of any argument that says that Congress does not intend for the pro-veteran canon to apply to veterans' benefits or the Veterans Act. In fact, it's the opposite. It's clear that Congress intends that the pro-veterans canon apply to provisions for benefits to members. And again, provisions for benefits to members, which is exactly what we have here. So I have a two-part question. Let's see. So first, is it your position that Section 5110B1 is crystal clear that it can never be equitably told under any circumstance, regardless of how extreme the facts are? Or instead, wouldn't you concede that there's at least some ambiguity in terms of whether Section 5110B1 may be equitably told in certain, let's say, extreme cases? And my second question is, assuming that it is at least somewhat ambiguous whether Section 5110B1 may be equitably told at all, why wouldn't the veterans canon tip the scales in favor of the veteran, at least so that it applies in narrow, extreme circumstances? You know, the veteran, pro-veterans canon has an impressive historical pedigree at the Supreme Court, as well as this court's precedent. And in this case, the doctrine applies to the veterans for their service-connected disability, something that we know exists in this particular case. So we have a veteran who's paid the price on his part. Apparently there's disability from the day he left the service until the day, well, until today. That's my question.
Yes, Your Honor. To be clear, we do believe that the statutory scheme is clear that equitable tolling is not permitted. We don't believe that there's any degree of ambiguity that would warrant invocation of the veterans canon. And I'd further
under
add,
any circumstance, that under any circumstance, regardless of how extreme the facts are.
Yes, Your Honor, because this suggestion that the availability the availability of tolling as a general proposition depends upon how extreme the facts are suggests, really attributes a degree of specificity to Irwin and to its presumption that is not realistic. It's a blunt instrument. Once the court moves past simply applying the presumption to reach the conclusion that the equitable tolling as that doctrine has long been understood under the common law is permissible, once the court begins to construct some narrower version of it or a new version for application only with respect to this statute, I think we've gone far beyond attempting to discern the intent of Congress into the court essentially rewriting the statutory scheme to reflect the court's sense of equity, which is, of course, not permissible. With respect to the veterans canon in general, again, if we go back to the question of legislative intent, congressional intent, when subsection B1 was passed in 1943, there was no veterans canon. The first sort of slight suggestion at it happened a few years later, but that was certainly not the strong form of it that was first articulated in the 90s. So Congress would have had no reason when it passed B1 in 1943 to think that in addition, that this statute, which itself is not a statute of limitations, would be transformed subject to a court sense of equity based upon a canon that was not yet known to the law.
Yet the law was began to formulate with Brown versus Gardner. Don't you agree?
In 1994?
Yes.
Yes, that was the origin of the current iteration or current approach to the veterans canon, yes.
And since that time, there hasn't been any court case or anything from Congress that indicates that the Gardner presumption, as it was known at that time, which is a pro-veterans canon, as we call it today, that it was infirm or somehow did not apply in certain situations. Wouldn't you agree that it applies in all cases involving statutory interpretation?
No, Your Honor. It only applies where there are two reasonable interpretations of the statute and the court is unable to decide which is the proper interpretation using other traditional tools of statutory interpretation. And I also kind of want to push back on the idea that the veterans canon, like the Irwin presumption, is really a blunt instrument. At the end of the day, it asks a court to decide what's in a veteran's favor, and that's really a position that a court is not institutionally best positioned to decide in many cases, including, I would say, this one where we're talking about where equitable tolling would involve trading off the administrative efficiency of the veterans benefit system against the relief that may be afforded to a relatively small number of claimants.
Well, of course,
I'm sorry, Judge Rayner, go ahead if you have something to follow up.
Well, I was just going to respond that of course the courts are called upon to decide these type of issues. And we're being called upon to decide whether there's any ambiguity or the applicability of Section 5110B1. And staring at me in the face is the Gardner presumption, what's known now the pro-veterans canon. And I asked you several questions, and I think you only referred or responded halfway. But anyway, I thank you for your response.
Judge Wallach.
Yes, thank you. Are you familiar with the facts of Taylor?
I am not, Your Honor.
Okay, I'll work through them with you then.
Okay.
We know that from 1955 to 1975, the Department of Defense undertook various human experiments, and that those experiments involved soldier volunteers who were exposed to chemical warfare agents. And we know that those volunteers were assigned secrecy oaths that they could not divulge, quote, any information relating to their participation in the experiments. Under penalty of a general court-martial, which under the Uniform Code of Military Justice at that time could result in a death penalty. In 1969, the DOD experimented on a soldier volunteer, exposing him to a nerve agent like VX or sarin to measure its effect on his performance. And we know that those nerve agents affect neural synapses and the ability of a soldier to effectively think. The soldier's deployed to Vietnam, and while on active duty, he tries to get medical care to deal with the consequences of his exposure, and he's turned away as, quote, a liar and malingerer. He's discharged in 1971. the DOD finally declassifies its experiments in 2006. That same year, the soldier volunteer receives a letter from the VA saying the DOD has now given permission for him to disclose to healthcare providers information about his involvement in testing programs. And he can speak to a VA representative. Right after that, he files a claim for service-connected benefits, or PTSD. The VA grants the volunteer's claim. Under our current law, what's the earliest effective date available for the soldier volunteer?
I believe that would be... I'm sorry?
It was 2006 when they declassified.
Right. So the date of the receipt of claim.
Okay. Is there any recourse available to him, any provision of law that might get him an earlier effective date than when the DOD gave him permission to file his claim?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. And obviously the scenario you're describing or the facts that you're describing are deeply disturbing and would warrant, as a policy matter, some kind of relief. But those are the kind of circumstances that are appropriate, precisely appropriate for Congress to address. And Congress has actually addressed the situation of veterans whose situation is quite similar to what you've just described. Now, to be clear, not, but would not cover the situation you're describing there as of yet. On page 45 of our brief, in a footnote, we cite to a statute that was passed by Congress in 2017 that addressed the situation of World War II veterans who were subjected to experimentation using mustard gas and who were also forbidden from discussing the details of those experiments, and who had difficulty ever even proving that they had been involved in the experiments because much of the documentation involved with them had been lost or destroyed. Congress provided, especially in that statutory scheme we cite on page 45, for a new adjudication of those claims brought by those veterans, and for the provision of certain special evidentiary rules or the application of certain special evidentiary rules to ensure that it was more likely the claims of those veterans would be granted. At the same time, Congress specified that there should be a special effective date assigned for those veterans, and the effective date was the date of the receipt of the prior claim that had been denied. So even in that case, which is quite similar and very sympathetic, where also the veterans were by the government's action prevented from receiving benefits earlier, the Congress did not display an inclination to change the default effective date rules, which only serves to emphasize that it is Congress's intent and will that the rules as they are written be applied, even in situations that are extremely sympathetic. Under a system of the rule of law, the best way of ensuring fairness in the system overall is to apply the rules of congressional statutes the way that they are written.
Yeah, it's interesting that you refer to a system of the rule of law, given the circumstances. One other question. Given Ferris and the Ferris Doctrine, could the soldier bring an action in tort?
I don't know, Your Honor. That occurred to me as well, but I don't have enough of a background in the Tort Claims Act to say. I believe that typically injuries growing out of military service are precluded. However, I don't know whether there might be some exception to that rule where the injury sort of arises after service in the form of, you know, an inability to file a claim promptly, for example. I don't know whether there might be some way of prosecuting a tort claim on those facts.
Yeah, unfortunately, the injury arose immediately. Okay, thank you. I'll pass.
Judge Toronto.
Sure. Can I just return to a subject that the Chief brought up with Mr. Barney right at the beginning and see if you can help illuminate it a little bit? If there's an equitable tolling doctrine, then how is that going to work in practice? Does each of the regional office adjudicators, I assume each one has to assign an effective date, and if that effective date is assigned in a way that's favorable to the veteran, under what circumstances, if any, can that be disturbed by the Secretary, the Board, the Veterans Court, and considering in particular the 2017 5104A provision about not disturbing veteran favorable findings? It's not absolute, but it's...
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe there probably would be a way of disturbing it once it was assigned. I mean, of course, there's the only way to reverse a favorable finding is upon a finding of clear and unmistakable error, but that usually requires a legal error.
Just to be clear, I think 5104A, oddly enough, uses clear and convincing evidence.
Okay. Well, so that also would be a standard that would be nearly impossible to meet because the equitable tolling is sort of a judgment call and is not. I suppose if the evidence actually suggested, if the evidence actually indicated the opposite of whatever the basis for tolling was, maybe there might be a ground for saying that clear and convincing evidence showed that it was wrong.
Can I just follow that up? I think Mr. Barney referred to the possibility of regulations, and you have a footnote, maybe footnote 6 or something in your brief, saying, we do have some regulatory authority, but since, as I understand it, the last sentence says, but we couldn't create a regulation about equitable tolling because it would be contrary to the statute. If this court were to disagree with the proposition that no equitable tolling is permitted under the statute or some categories of equitable tolling, if we were to say might be available under the statute, would there be regulatory authority?
Well, if the court held that some form of equitable tolling were allowed by the statute, that the statute didn't in fact bar it, and that holding stood, then obviously the VA would no longer be precluded. The question would be then whether the VA would choose to promulgate a rule that adopted equitable tolling authority. This goes back to the point that the VA doesn't have inherent equitable power. This would depend on the form of the court's decision, obviously. So if the court said that the VA has inherent equitable power, that would be different. But if the idea is just that the court says, well, the statute doesn't in fact prohibit it, so you could adopt a rule if you wanted to, then the VA would have the discretion to do that. But I don't believe that there would be authority for the court to, direct the VA to do so.
Good. Thank you.
Judge Chen?
Yes, I'd like to just quickly first follow up on your response to a question by Judge O'Malley when it came to situations where a statute provides some equity-based exceptions to some kind of time provision, time limit. And I believe you said, well, what the Supreme Court does in those situations to figure out whether there's still a broad equitable tolling background principle available is to see whether those equity-based exceptions in the statute would be encompassed by equitable tolling or not. And if they were, then that's clear evidence that Congress displaced equitable tolling. Can you just quickly cite what are the cases in which that's what happened, where the Supreme Court concluded that equitable tolling was displaced, and are there other cases that you're aware of where the court said, no, it wasn't displaced?
Sure. So the court found that, that equitable tolling was displaced in Brockamp, for example. It found that it wasn't displaced in Young, which was a case where the court looked at exceptions and, or at least one exception, and said that that exception was actually a supplement to equitable tolling, and therefore didn't, you know, suggest that Congress meant to displace it. There may be others, but I'm having I would probably need to take a little more time to marshal them all.
Okay. Thanks. And then following up on a response you gave to a question from Chief Judge Prost, who was asking you about some of these look-back provisions in cases like Petrella and maybe also SCA Hygiene, where the argument from the other side is that these are provisions that cut back on the amount of remedies available to a party through some kind of time period. And that's precisely what's happening here to Mr. Arellano, because any chance for backward-looking compensation is getting cut off from him. So, yes, he's getting some remedies going forward, but he's losing all remedies looking backward. And so, therefore, there's a link between this situation in front of us and situations in cases like Petrella and SCA Hygiene. I was wondering if you could respond to that.
Sure. The difference between the two situations is that the copyright statute of limitations and the Patent Act statute of limitations, even though they eliminate damages for particular claims. So if the act of infringement occurred outside of the limitations period, there's no damages for that act, which itself constitutes an independent claim. So that is a wholly conventional statute of limitations in that way, that after a certain period of time, the claim is barred. In this case, the claim isn't barred. There is still a remedy, the same remedy, available for the claim after the passage of the one-year period. It's true that the amount may be somewhat less, but that doesn't change the nature or the availability of the fundamental remedy. And the court in Brockamp, I think, made clear that the mere fact that recovery may be limited based upon some look-back period doesn't mean that we're talking about a statute of limitations. And the court in that case addressed a provision of the statutory scheme at issue that said that where the timeliness of the claim for tax refund was based upon the fact that the tax had been paid within 2 years of the filing of the complaint, only that portion of the tax that had been paid within the past 2 years could be recovered. And the court classified that statutory provision as a substantive limit on the amount of recovery and said that it found no direct precedent for tolling that type of limitation, which indicates that the court did not view that as a statute of limitations.
Right. So doesn't that make Brockamp a stronger case for finding no tolling compared to this one?
Yes, I mean, Brockamp is strong support for the conclusion that there should be no tolling of this statute.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is that's a more compelling case for reaching the conclusion of no tolling in Brockamp compared to the statute that we have here.
Oh, well, that statute wasn't the one. I'm not sure that I'm answering the question. I understand the question. So that statute wasn't the one that the party in Brockamp was seeking to toll as an initial matter. That the statute they wanted to toll was a statute of limitations. It was the one that said that a claim must be brought within the 2 years after the tax is paid, either that or within 3 years after the return was due. That was the one that the party wanted to toll, and the court found, among other reasons for finding that the presumption was rebutted, that doing that would require tolling also this other statutory provision that functioned as a substantive limit on the amount of recovery. And as we point out in our brief, this statute also is a limit upon the amount of recovery. It doesn't eliminate the remedy, and it doesn't provide repose because the claim is still viable, and it still has to be decided on all the same elements. The only thing that happens after the expiration of the time period in question is that the amount that can be recovered is limited in one parameter, which is analogous to the statute in Brockamp.
Okay, thank you.
Judge Hughes?
Pass.
Judge Stoll?
Good morning. Can you assume, for my purposes and my question, assume that the Irwin presumption applies? When thinking about whether Congress intended for this statute to allow equitable tolling or not, how do we factor in that most veterans are pro se and the agency is supposed to help claimants? I was surprised that this was not addressed or discussed in the government's brief, especially given some statements in cases like Sebelius and Zipes. And I'm thinking about Justice Sotomayor's concurrence, where she said that with respect to remedial status statutes designed to protect the rights of unsophisticated claimants, agencies and reviewing courts may best honor congressional intent by presuming that statutory deadlines for administrative appeals are subject to equitable tolling. What is the government's position?
Yes, Your Honor. So that's a factor that may be considered as one among several in support for a conclusion that tolling is permitted, but not one that has ever been found in and of itself sufficient to show that tolling should be allowed. And I would say that the counterweight to that argument is twofold. First, while it's true that claimants in the VA system are unsophisticated, relatively speaking, much of the time, it's also the case that that system is designed to take account of that and to make it extremely easy to file a claim. In fact, under 38 CFR 3.155, it's not even necessary to file a claim to get an effective date. All you have to do is tell the VA that you intend to file a claim, and as long as you file one within the year after you give that notice of intent, you get that notice of intent is treated, the date of that is treated as the date of the filing of the claim. So the barrier, and the notice of intent doesn't have to say, you know, what disability you're claiming or what the underlying basis of your claim is. It only has to say what kind of benefit you want. So while it's true that the claimants may be relatively unsophisticated compared to some administrative schemes, it's also true that it is extremely easy to file a claim in the VA system, and therefore the interest in or the likelihood that a claimant is going to be prevented from filing in a reasonably prompt manner is less. It's also the case that for all the this goes to the proposition that this court has said a number of times that for all the beneficence that's reflected in the veterans benefit scheme, that general benevolence doesn't point to a specific result in a particular situation or on a particular issue. And in this case, I would say that the very specific deadlines set in Section 5110, which are repeated and are the same for every class of claimant and for every equitable consideration and limited to 1 year, would suggest that a general benevolence is not sufficient to show that Congress wanted those deadlines to be flexible for equitable reasons.
Yes, I understand, but my question to you was, it's a factor we should consider, right? It is a factor that we should consider, that this is intended to, you know, that most of the veterans are pro se, the agency is supposed to help the claimants, and Congress has a particular liking of veterans. Is that right? I mean, we should at least
certainly, certainly, Your Honor, it's an appropriate factor to consider all aspects of the statutory scheme that may be relevant or appropriate to consider.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Thomas, this is Judge Prowse. Let me bring you back briefly to Judge Wallach's concerns, and I think they were paralleled by some of what Judge Dyke was asking about. In footnote 6, you cite to the statutory provision 501A, and you cite some of the regulations that have been promulgated for just cause by the Secretary. Is it your view that the Secretary would not have the ability to issue a regulation that dealt maybe, as Judge Dyke suggested, with more with the duty to assist than anything else, when the VA is precluded from assisting a veteran in pursuing his claim because of national security requirements? Could the Secretary not issue a regulation creating an exception for that kind of circumstance?
I think that the VA Secretary probably could create a regulation to address that circumstance by not framing it necessarily so much as a form of tolling or extending the deadlines in 5110, but perhaps by addressing the way, perhaps treating an earlier date as the date of claim submission for certain types of claimants or treating on the grounds that they had been prevented from filing earlier.
Thank you. Judge Newman.
No. I pass.
Judge Lurie.
No question.
Judge Dyke.
Yes, let me just try once more. Let's assume the Irwin presumption applies, and that we look at it in a categorical way, and we find the presumption's been rebutted with respect to disability, so there's no tolling there. What is it in this statute that suggests that the Irwin presumption has been rebutted in the what might be called the Rabine-Taylor situation, where it is the government's fault that it wasn't filed earlier? What is it here in this statute that rebuts the Irwin presumption in that situation?
Yeah, I don't know if I can give you an answer that you would find more satisfying than the ones I've already provided.
I take that as that you can't find anything. Thank you.
Well, to be clear, Your Honor, I have provided reasons previously that I believe do indicate that it would not be consistent with congressional intent to create a special tolling rule for the Rabine situation. Of course, it is the court's prerogative not to find them persuasive.
Judge Moore? I'm sorry. Did you have anything else, Judge Dyke?
No.
Judge Moore?
Pass.
Judge O'Malley?
I just want to go back for a second to Judge Stoll's question. I mean, clearly it is a factor. I mean, it's not just the Sebelius case that talks about it being a factor, the nature of the benefit scheme, but they cite to a number of other cases as well in Sebelius that support that proposition. But you answered that, well, it's such a friendly scheme that they already get a lot of breaks, and it's already made easy, and so it would be extremely unlikely that anyone would ever be really prevented from filing. First of all, doesn't the fact that there are lots of benefits for veterans just further support the proposition that that's what Congress intended this whole scheme to be? And isn't it true that if it's extremely unlikely that anyone would be able to satisfy the request for equitable tolling and receive equitable tolling, doesn't that undercut your argument that we're somehow going to open a floodgate of cases and drain the VA's coffers?
Yes, Your Honor. So with respect to the court's first point, I think that the heavy reliance upon the general beneficence of the veterans scheme here threatens to go against the court's warning in Irwin that there should not be a presumption applied against the government that's more favorable to the claimant than would be in the case for a private party. I think that there is that the veterans canon, as applied to veterans benefits, runs the risk of disregarding the fact that this still applicable rule that waivers upon the government's sovereign immunity are still to be strictly construed. The presumption provides some, provides a rebuttal to that, but still with the proviso that we need to keep in mind that we shouldn't think that the government should be subjected to more generous tolling provisions than any other party would be. Second, with respect to the court's other question, the VA's concern, the government's concern with the proposition of widespread availability of equitable tolling in this instance is not limited to just the question of whether there would be more benefits paid out. In fact, I would say even more concerning is the fact that, yes, though there might be few people who would benefit from ultimately, substantively, from the rule, there would be likely a large, very large influx of people who would claim the benefit of equitable tolling, even if they were going to ultimately lose. And that is, in fact, I would say any claimant who didn't get the an effective date of day after discharge would be tempted to argue entitlement to equitable tolling. And that would be a massively intensive factual inquiry that the VA at the RO level would have to engage in, that the board would have to engage in, and that the Veterans Court would then have to review, which would mean further administrative disruption of the system, which already involves a level of procedural complexity that threatens to, at points, grind it to a halt.
Judge Reyna.
No questions.
Judge Wallach.
Nothing further.
Judge Toronto.
Nothing further.
Judge Chen.
Just a quick question. How would you sum up the right way to think about Sebelius in the sense that, on the one hand, the opinion seems to say statutory internal agency timing provisions are not suitable for equitable tolling. On the other hand, it seems to suggest, well, those were sophisticated players making filings inside of an agency, and therefore the inference is for unsophisticated claimants like the ones we have here, combined with the special form of solicitude we give veterans when they're seeking benefits to make them whole due to injuries during service, militate in favor of finding equitable tolling. So I'm just wondering, how would you, in sum up, think about what's the right way to think about Sebelius for purposes of this case?
Sure. I don't think Sebelius, honestly, is dispositive on the issue of whether equitable tolling is available for administrative deadlines, as indicated by the fact that the court relied upon numerous factors, in arriving at the conclusion that equitable tolling was not available for the deadline there, and the court's job there was simplified as well, in some part by the fact that the agency, the HHS, had promulgated a regulation that addressed the question of timeliness and provided for some degree of tolling, and therefore sort of indicated that the agency itself thought it had some regulatory authority to do that. So I don't think that the court in Sebelius established that there was any one factor that indicates whether an administrative deadline can be tolled, but rather that it's appropriate to consider various relevant factors. Now, the court there didn't address the question of whether an administrative agency possesses equitable authority to toll a deadline, and it is still not clear where such authority would come from. And then I'd like to respond to a point on this issue made by Mr. Barney. Mr. Barney suggested that the Supreme Court found in Zipes that an administrative tolling was subject to administrative deadline was subject to equitable tolling. That's not precisely true. The court found in Zipes that a district court could waive an untimely filing of an administrative claim because that timely filing is usually a condition precedent to the case being heard on the merits in court. The Supreme Court in Zipes did not find that the EEOC had the authority to waive that deadline.
Judge Hughes.
Pass.
Judge Stoll.
Pass.
Well, we're about 3.5 minutes beyond time, Ms. Thomas. If you want to take a minute to wrap up, and then we'll even out the time with Mr. Barney.
Sure, Your Honor. I'll just say that while we're aware that there may be pressing equitable considerations in certain cases that would suggest that as a policy matter that tolling might be desirable, it still remains the case that Congress and Congress alone under the Appropriations Clause has the authority to determine under what conditions the government is obliged to pay out money to claimants. And congressional intent, we believe, is clear that equitable tolling is not permitted under this statutory scheme. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Barney?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your rebuttal time. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. If the status quo is left in place and Andrews continues to be construed as a complete bar to equitable tolling of 5110B1, then, and this is following up on several questions, then situations such as Rabine, Taylor, and many other situations that you can imagine are truly, truly deserving of at least the opportunity to argue for equitable tolling would be completely barred. So I want to emphasize, I believe it's clear, but I just want to emphasize again, we are not asking the court to rule on or address or actually make any comments on the actual factual merits of this case and the fact that 30 years has elapsed, for instance. We're asking for a correction of what we believe to be an error in the law that affects all veterans, including Mr. Arellano, but also including the veteran in Rabine, Taylor, and many other cases. Now, the government, in response to one of the questions regarding, I believe it was the Taylor case, suggested that it would be best addressed by Congress. Our position is it already has been addressed by Congress because when Congress legislates, it's presumed to do so against the background principles of equitable tolling. And so it has already put a statutory time limit in place that is subject to equitable tolling, which if the equities show, in other words, if the merits of a claim show entitlement to equitable tolling, that would provide relief for veterans such as Rabine and Taylor, Mr. Arellano. Now, I do want to follow up on, I know that Judge Dyke had asked several questions along this line, and I want to make sure that our position is clear in response to his question. I do understand that what he is suggesting is to parse the degree of the applicability of the Irwin presumption and perhaps to pronounce that the Irwin presumption is rebutted for certain types of factual scenarios, but not for others. Our feeling is that that would not be the most efficient way to do this. The most efficient way to do it would simply be to overrule Andrews, make clear that equitable tolling is applicable to 5110B1, and let the lower court apply the existing jurisprudence on equitable tolling. There is a very well-developed body of law on equitable tolling, so they're not starting from a blank slate. And the lower court and this court as well will be able to, in time, parse out which categories are going to be viewed as good candidates or appropriate candidates for equitable tolling. Now, going back to the two basic inquiries that I started with in my opening argument, in terms of whether the presumption applies at all. I think the only real roadblock that the government has raised is whether or not the provision, 5110B1, is sufficiently like a statute of limitations to be entitled to the presumption. And we've gone through a number of cases, Young and Zipes and Fisher and even Scarborough, which, by the way, was an application for EJIA fees, which the court analogized to a fee-shifting provision, which really is nothing like a statute of limitations. And yet all of those cases found that the statute, that the time limit in question was amenable to equitable tolling. We've also pointed to the damages statute in the patent field, which, again, even this court didn't think it was a statute of limitations, but the Supreme Court disagreed. So there's a lot of ambiguity about what is or is not a statute of limitations. And going to Judge Reyna's question, to the extent there's ambiguity here, it should be resolved in the veteran's favor. Now, the government several times pointed out that this is the same remedy. So unlike a situation like the copyright statute of limitations, where you're getting a continuous tort and you're getting a new remedy each time, the government argues this is the same remedy. Whether you get it whether your effective award date is your date of filing or an earlier date is the same remedy, that is simply not true. It is a different remedy. A veteran perceives, and correctly so, that getting an earlier date of award is a different remedy. You get more, it's a different remedy in the exact same way that getting more damages in a patent case or getting more damages in a copyright case is a different remedy. And those, I don't think the court has said anything about equitable tolling in the patent context, but certainly in the copyright context, that is subject to equitable tolling. Now, going to the second prong, can the court rebut it? Again, there have been many arguments raised, but I think the one that we keep coming back to is whether the structure of the statute should be viewed in the nature of exceptions to a general rule, whether those exceptions should be deemed to be equitable in nature, and whether that puts this case into a category like the TRW case, where because Congress set forth a bunch of exceptions, that augurs towards not reading in a general equitable exception. We don't believe the government has the better part of that argument. These exceptions are not written in the way they were written in TRW and other cases of that nature, like Brockamp. There's nothing that stops the clock. These are not exceptions that say, for instance, if you file in the wrong court, the period stops, or if you are in receipt of disinformation from the government, the clock stops. There are no exceptions like that that would stop the running of the clock in 5110B1. Now, that brings us to the B4, you know, the 5110B4, where there does appear to be some sort of an equitable consideration. But as several of the questions have pointed out, that cuts both ways. And we think it actually cuts more in our way than the government's way. The case law, the government would have Brockamp on its side, and it would have the TRW case on its side, but we have Holland, Young, and Clower on our side. And again, to the extent there's some tension or ambiguity between those cases and how they apply to this particular set of facts, we think the general rule that veteran statutes are to be construed in favor of the veteran would apply here. That is all I have, Your Honors. If there's any time left and you have additional questions for me, I'd be happy to answer them.
Well, we're close to the end. Hearing nothing, no shout-outs from my colleagues, I will please to bring this to a close. I want to thank the parties. We understand these are difficult times and unusual circumstances, and you've been very cooperative, and it's much appreciated. And of course, on behalf of my colleagues, I'd like to thank our terrific staff, which always steps up and does a great job for us, as they did today. So with that, I will conclude the proceedings. The case is submitted. Thank you all.
The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 a.m.